Welcome to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Today on the program, we hear about the life and legacy of Ponca Tribe Chief Standing Bear. In September of last year, in Statuary Hall in Washington, D.C., a new piece went up. This statue was of the hero of the Ponca Tribe. Chief Standing Bear was installed with a special ceremony. There is a new documentary about Chief Standing Bear's path to Statuary Hall in Washington, D.C. We'll hear some of the film and hear from the producers after the film's premiere at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln's Lead Center on Tuesday night. We'll talk with a UNL journalism professor who's written a book about the life of Chief Standing Bear that has inspired a planned Hollywood film that will be filmed in Nebraska along the Niobrara River, where Chief Standing Bear and the tribe were settled before a national order to leave their homeland. In the late 19th century, the Ponca people were forced off their last remaining sliver of land in Nebraska to Indian Territory in Oklahoma. The Ponca wanted to return to their home, and Chief Standing Bear had promised to bring his son home as the boy died in the freezing cold of Oklahoma. The chief's efforts to return his son's body to the tribe's ancestral lands and the legal battle that ensued transformed Chief Standing Bear into a civil rights icon. First today, we hear part one of a series on Chief Standing Bear from writer and creator of Small Wonders on Siouxland Public Media, Jim Scopp. Here's part one of the story of Standing Bear.
Part one. To be sure, there was a good reason for the Poncas to cut the deal they did with this strange emissary who showed up one day from Washington. He'd come to let him know that the Great Father wanted the Poncas to move from their homeland on the Missouri River to Indian country, what would become Oklahoma, to a place where, he claimed, they'd be safe from raids by larger and more warlike neighbors. That argument was, for the Ponca, not total garbage. The Poncas were warriors, but they were few in number when compared to the Brule Sioux. What's more, their culture was not as nomadic. They'd put down roots on the Niobrara River, literally and figuratively, planted crops long before white men determined agriculture was what they wanted all native people to do. The Poncas had no desire to leave home, but escaping suffering was nothing to sneeze at, so they cut a deal. It was January 1872. Supplies were scarce, as was food. So they told this stranger that they'd agree to his demands if, first, 10 Ponca chiefs could go south to see if it was a place they could abide. If it was good land, they might agree, but only if they could visit Washington themselves to talk to the Great Father about a move they didn't want to make. What those 10 chiefs found in Indian Territory was ground impossible to farm, and residents who seemed to live without hope. We did not wish to sink as low as they seemed to be. Standing Bear, one of the 10 chiefs, said, "We're not moving." That's when they were told they had no choice. In a hotel room in a border town in Kansas, Standing Bear decided they were leaving Indian Territory, bound for home, directionless. "Let's go anyway," he told the others. That night, 8 chiefs left the 2 others, both sick, and walked on railroad tracks north, confident of somehow finding their way back to the Niobrara, 2 entire states away. 18 days later, they reached the Nebraska border, feet so bloody they left footprints on the floor of the Oto tribal agent. Suffering had been immense. It was late March before they reached the Omahas, their relatives and friends. On March 30, 1872, Chief Standing Bear stood in the offices of the Sioux City Daily Journal and handed the editor a letter recounting their suffering and their unjust fate. The editor published that long letter the next day and told his readers that the Ponca's story demanded attention from any person in this country who believed that every human being, however humble, is entitled to the same justice claimed for themselves. Other neighbors wrote letters directly to the president protesting the Ponca's treatment and the demand that they remove themselves from their traditional home and move to Indian Territory, a place that looked nothing like the earth where their ancestors lay. That letter recounted the Ponca's painful 500-mile journey across rivers and streams in March. "We have been 30 days getting back as far as the Omahas, hungry, tired, shoeless, footsore, and sad at heart. Please answer at once, for we are in trouble," their letter to the president said. The answer they received was waiting for them when they returned to the Niobrara. That man had asked Washington's superiors himself. "Removal of the Poncas will be insisted upon," he was told. Soon, painfully, those eight chiefs and 500 Ponca were told in no uncertain terms that the question of whether they would live in Indian Territory had been determined. All of them, young and old, every Ponca in the villages along the Niobrara, they all had to leave for Indian Territory. Those chiefs had already suffered their own trail of tears, but there would be yet another, this one much worse, much harder, much bigger, and far more heart-rending.
That was Jim Skop, creator of Small Wonders on Siouxland Public Media, with the first part of the story of Standing Bear. We'll hear more a little later. The new documentary, Chief Standing Bear, A Journey to Statuary Hall, follows the chief's life and how his statue became installed in Statuary Hall. The documentary was previewed last night at a special event at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln's Lead Center. The event also featured a panel discussion with the makers of the film, the sculptor Benjamin Victor, and Native American leaders like Larry Wright, the leader of the Nebraska Ponca tribe. Here's what Larry Wright had to say about the film before the screening.
Aho, Ponca Moshe Wongide. It's an honor to be asked to be here tonight and do the invocation and land acknowledgement. And on behalf of the Ponca Nation, I want to recognize the other three federally recognized headquartered tribes in Nebraska, the Santee Sioux Nation, the Winnebago Nation, and the Omaha Nation. And I also want to recognize all of Nebraska before we had these geopolitical borders. 26 indigenous tribes called this state home. Long before anyone else was here, and we lived here together. And I want to acknowledge all of those nations that wherever they are at today, that this will always be their homeland. And with that, I'd like to say this invocation. I ask that you forgive me, speak in front of my elders, wherever they may be watching today. And please bow your heads and pray in your way. Oho, Wakanda. Then the Haudani, Ombade, Wadaikte, Esti, Wiblihon Shidade, Shidego, Wongide, Agatikte, Wiblihon Shidade, Ponkungadi, Bruga, the Onwa Gidaga, Nyonshinga, Ukedi, Wongide, Ekitaha, Walombaga, Nyonshinga, Wanoshe Hidi, Esti, Daeda de Komblega. Great Spirit, we thank you for this day. We thank you for allowing each of us to be here. It's good to pray to you. I ask that you watch over all of our Ponca people, all the tribal nations, our veterans, and all those that come here today as we work together to celebrate this accomplishment and all of those who work so hard to make this happen through their hard work, their creative vision, and all of those that help share this story for this generation and the next. We ask that you watch over all those people that are suffering because of this COVID disease, all those that have lost their lives, their families who are struggling, those that have this disease now. Help us be strong with each other and for each other. And thank you for all these things. Ede wongide, all my relations. Thank you.
That was Larry Wright Jr., the leader of the Ponca Tribe of Nebraska. We'll hear more from him later on. The co-directors of the film are Judy Gashkibosh, the executive director of the Nebraska Commission on Indian Affairs, and documentary filmmaker Ingrid Holmquist. We'll hear from Gashkibosh later on. Next, we talk with Ingrid Holmquist, who is a graduate of UNL. Holmquist says Gashkibosh was the driving force behind this documentary.
She wanted to document the Chief Standing Bear statue going into Statuary Hall at this momentous moment with, you know, there's so many different layers to it. And it's, you know, the layer of education about who Chief Standing Bear was and him as an important figure to people outside of Nebraska, which I think, I mean, that's such a momentous thing that so many people outside of the Native community and outside of Nebraska don't even know who Chief Standing Bear is. And now he's this looming, large, beautiful structure in the U.S. Capitol. And so that was the main goal, because there have been Chief Standing Bear legacy documentaries that have been done by NET and others. But of course, in order to tell the story about why this statue is so momentous and why it's important to have his story so front and center in the U.S. Capitol, I needed to, of course, share about his life in the film. And so that was mostly done through interviews with his direct descendants and two Standing Bear scholars like Joe Sterita and his direct descendants that were in the film that helped relay his story and recount his story were the Steve Larvey and Steve Larvey Jr. and Alice Erickson are all direct descendants of Chief Standing Bear. So to me, that was really extremely important to have people who are direct descendants of this amazing civil rights leader sharing his story. So that was a big focus. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then a number of other people were also recounted it.
It's kind of all coming together for me now, you know, the intense amount of scholarship that's been done on Chief Standing Bear.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's something that for me, you know, it's so amazing to have professors and historians and authors and filmmakers, learning about and then giving out the story. But for me, what's even more impactful is hearing it from his direct descendants, which is something that I wanted to be extra careful of. You know, there's a difference between the emotional weight that someone who's a direct descendant or someone who's of the Ponca tribe versus someone who's studied. And especially as a white person, I wanted to be really specific about that being the most important voices in the story.
The thing about Chief Standing Bear that really, I think, gets to most of us is he was concerned not just with human rights of his own people, but with the human rights of everyone, despite everything his people had gone through.
Right, right. And it wasn't just the Ponca people, too. You know, his words were speaking for, as Steve Larvey Jr. in the film says, the words that he said in that courtroom were not just for Ponca people, for his people, but for all Indigenous people. And, you know, that's truly at the core of what he stood for.
That was Ingrid Holmquist, one of the directors of the new documentary, Chief Standing Bear, A Journey to Statuary Hall. We'll speak with the co-director a bit later in the program. First, though, here is the second part of the Jim Scop series, The Story of Standing Bear.
The Standing Bear Story, Part 2. Forget every cavalry versus Indian show you ever saw. Get it out of your consciousness. The Ponca story is not like them. There'd never, ever been a hostile problem with the Poncas. They'd signed a treaty 60 years before, so when the mounted cavalry from Fort Randall came riding into the Ponca villages, no Ponca had ever seen the army before. Can you imagine? The wailing that whole night was robust. No one wanted to leave. The next morning, in come these fighting men with guns and swords. When a lawyer from nearby Niobrara came by and confronted the official, told him taking the Poncas away was a miscarriage of justice, he was told Washington's plans were written in stone. The dignity of the government demands that it should go ahead. What he meant was it would look bad now for the government to back down. So 500 Poncas, warned there'd be no food if they refused to go, spent a night crying so loud that their white neighbors heard the wailing. Then, scared and hungry, they packed up their earthly belongings on wagons and readied themselves. Standing Bear stood firm. "This land is ours," he said. "It belongs to us. You have no right to take it." About that, Standing Bear was wrong. Washington could do what it wanted because in the United States of America in 1877, Native Americans weren't Americans at all. They weren't people. They weren't even human beings. On May 19, after unending rain, the column of Poncas crossed the rain-swollen Niobrara and headed south, their military escort with them. Abundant tears fell on this horrific trek. Already on the second day, beset by relentless rain and cold, a child died and was buried the next day in the village of Creighton. Then they marched 25 miles to Neatley, where, once again, a child, stricken with pneumonia, died. A carpenter in town fashioned a casket and a cross was set down beside the marker where the father of the little girl made the townspeople promise they would care for the grave. "I may never see it again," he told them. "Care for it for me." All these years later, the grave of that little girl named White Buffalo Girl is still blanketed with fresh flowers, the only decorated burial spot in the entire Laurel Hill Cemetery. Two children were lost in 5 days. The rains continued. The cold held them icily in its unforgiving hand. No doctors accompanied them. No medicine was to be found. On June 6, after burying yet another child, Prairie Flower, a storm arose, such as I never before experienced, the agent wrote in his journal. It was a tornado. Some of the people were taken up by the wind and carried as much as 300 yards without touching the ground, he wrote. Amid the crying and lament, he said, I earnestly hope to be spared any similar experience in the future. By the time they reached Indian Territory, the Ponca people had crossed two states, some aboard wagons, many of them walking. 9 people had died. They'd reached their destination, a place achingly far from home, unlike anything they'd ever experienced, pushed onto land already owned by another tribe who weren't even told about the Poncas. Heat and humidity was sweltering. The grand plan of the United States of America was to place all of the native people in a region where they would be together, as if all tribes were carbon copy cultures. The list goes on and on. Oto, Missouri, Wichita, Pawnee, Kaw, Osage, Cheyenne, Apache, and more, all pushed together in a region General William Sherman once claimed to be a parcel of land set aside for Indians surrounded by thieves. They were in the way of progress, America's manifest destiny.
And that was part two of Jim Scott's series, The Story of Chief Standing Bear. We'll hear the third part of the story in just a moment. Support for The Exchange comes from Gregory Giles, investment advisor representative with Legacy Financial LLC in Sioux City, serving the financial planning and investment needs of clients since 2004. Information about Legacy Financial and Greg Giles is available at legacyfinancialllc.com. Financial planning and advisory services offered through RDA Financial Network. And now we'll hear the third installment of Jim Scott's series, The Story of Chief Standing Bear.
The Standing Bear Story, Part 3. Warm country, the Poncas called it, Indian Territory, what would become Oklahoma, didn't sit well for the Poncas, didn't feel at all like home, and offered no rest for the weary, just another hardcore stretch of hunger and sickness. Weary and hungry when they arrived, they stayed weary and hungry for months. The government promised wagons but didn't distribute them, afraid the Poncas would sneak back home. The government provided plows but no oxen. The Poncas' horses were skin and bones. The people were living, just barely, in canvas tents, distanced from each other by an agent who thought keeping them apart would keep them from plotting some dark of night escape. Salty water all around pushed them to vomit. A year after their arrival, they'd all lost faith in the government and abandoned hope. I stayed till 158 of my people had died, Standing Bear explained later. Then I ran away with 30 of my people, men and women and children. Some of the children were orphans. Mid-afternoon, January 2, 1879, 30 Poncas and 3 wagons left amid mid-afternoon sub-zero temperatures that continued to fall every hour. Standing Bear had lost his firstborn, Bear Shield, a young man, his third child to die since they'd been marched away from their homes and their land. Before he died, Bear Shield begged his father to bring his bones to the land of his grandfathers on the Niobrara. I promised him I would, he told people. I could not refuse the dying request of my boy. A trunk in one of those wagons that January afternoon held the remains of his son. The agent in warm country stayed holed up in the January cold while those 30 Poncas began the long trek home. 6 days passed before he knew they were gone. 6 days. The landscape from eastern Oklahoma through Kansas and Nebraska alters only slightly. Here and there, cottonwoods rise from the valleys of occasional rivers across the Poncas path, offering the only sustaining shelter from icy winds. What money they'd taken with them and the commodities they'd packed were quickly exhausted, forcing them to beg to stay alive. You may be surprised to learn that white homesteaders, most as poor as Standing Bear's people, only rarely didn't or wouldn't feed them and find them shelter. On March 4, 62 days after they'd left Indian Territory, Suzette LaFleche, Bright Eyes, and her Omaha friends were told that the Poncas had arrived out west of the Omahas, where they were camped, regaining strength. The Omaha and Poncas were cousins. Between them, there was blood and a storehouse of goodwill. Planting season was about to begin, so the Omaha offered their relatives open land to grow crops, just as they had once done beside the Niobrara. But thousands of miles away, Washington would not tolerate the humiliation the Poncas had slapped on their great authority by defying its demands. and administering the law, bringing them back once more to Indian country, fell to Brigadier General George Crook, the premier Indian fighter. Crook's power had distinguished him in the Civil War as well as in Indian wars all over the West. At that moment, General Crook's residence was at Fort Omaha, where you can still visit his house today. General Crook had always been his own man, sometimes off for days all by himself while his troops were on whatever mission he'd appointed. But he's established a military record like none other. And Washington never doubted his allegiance or his valor. As commanded, General Crook and his troops traveled up from Fort Omaha to the Ponca encampment west of the Omaha Reservation and demanded Standing Bear's people return with him and his troops to the fort until ready to move once again back to warm country. Standing Bear and his people were physically worn and emotionally beaten by their long midwinter pilgrimage. The future looked bleak as the late winter countryside. No one, not Crook, not Standing Bear, not the Omahas, not the settlers still moving into eastern Nebraska, no one would have or could have even begun to guess what would happen next.
That was Small Wonders' Jim Scop with the Standing Bear story. This feature is part of a collaboration between Avery Brothers Sign Company and Siouxland Public Media entitled Sioux City, A Shared History. Support for Small Wonders on Siouxland Public Media comes from the Daniels Osborne Law Firm in the Ho-Chunk Center in downtown Sioux City, serving the needs of clients in real estate transactions, business formation and guidance, and personal estate planning. More information is available on Facebook or at danielsosborne.com. And we'll hear the final part of that Jim Scop series in a few minutes. The story of Chief Standing Bear was told in heartrending fashion in a book by University of Nebraska-Lincoln Professor of Journalism and Mass Communication, Joe Sturita. The book is called I Am a Man, and it has inspired a major motion picture that will be filmed in Nebraska along the Niobrara River. Sturita was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize in History for the book, which has been translated into six languages. Sturita says the story of Chief Standing Bear is an epic tale of one man who prevails despite overwhelming odds.
It's Captain Ahab and the Great White Whale. It's Atticus Finch fighting for social justice against overwhelming odds in the deeply racist South and triumphing. And those are the kinds of stories that we as people from the earliest days of storytelling have always kind of gravitated to. I mean, here is a middle-aged chief, a middle-aged American Indian chief of a small tribe in a remote, isolated corner of the Great Plains, who one day in the spring of 1879 walks into federal court and sues the entire government of the United States. And unlike Dred Scott 22 years earlier, Standing Bear won. Standing Bear won. And the question then becomes, how did that happen? How did this middle-aged chief of a small tribe in an obscure part of the country walk into a federal court and take on the government of the United States and bring the government of the United States to its knees without ever firing a shot from his Winchester, without ever plucking an arrow from his quiver, without ever unsheathing his scalping knife? How did he do that? How did that happen? That's not supposed to happen. And I would say that the reasons why it did happen are what makes the story very compelling and very emotional and very fulfilling once you start peeling away the layers and seeing why he won, how he pulled that off. And I would argue that he was able to triumph in a place and time that was extraordinarily stacked against him because this story is so human. It's such a human story. This isn't an American Indian chief, ultimately, in the eyes of Judge Elmer Dundy. This is a grieving father. This is a father whose only act of betrayal was to try and walk 550 miles into the teeth of a raging Canadian blizzard without any food, money, or winter clothing, simply so he could fulfill a deathbed promise that he had made to his 16-year-old son, Bearshield, his only son, who begged him shortly before his eyes closed in death on Christmas week of 1878, lying on the bottom of a cheap, dank army canvas tent in northern Oklahoma, "Please, Father, please take my body to our sacred burial sites on the Niobrara River." And Standing Bear agreed he would fulfill that promise. And so he did. He left with 29 other Ponca in January of 1879. The day he left, the United States government had entered into 375 treaties with its native people, and it had broke all 375 of those treaties. But Standing Bear, this middle-aged chief of a small tribe from a remote corner of the Great Plains, was not going to break the promise he had made his son. And that comes through time after time after time on the third floor of a brick building on the corner of 15th and Dodge Streets in Omaha, Nebraska, where this grizzled frontier bear hunting judge listened to this middle-aged man talk about the promise he had made his son. And he did not see an Indian. He did not see a savage. He did not see a chief. He saw a grieving father. And on May 12, 1879, after hearing all of the evidence, he wrote a really passionate, eloquent decision in favor of Chief Standing Bear that declared for the first time in the 103-year history of this country that from that day forward, an American Indian would have to be regarded as a human being within the meaning of the law, entitled to the same constitutional privileges as the more fortunate white race. And that is still one of the most powerful legal decisions made in the history of Nebraska. And I think both Judge Dundee and a number of courtroom observers, this is another thing about the magic of this story that played out in a number of ways, is that Standing Bear made everyone around him better. He had that unique quality that comes through in his story.
That was University of Nebraska-Lincoln Professor of Journalism and Mass Communication, Joe Sterita. He's the author of the book, I Am a Man, a biography of Ponca tribe leader Chief Standing Bear. The book has inspired a major motion picture about the life of the civil rights leader. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Today on the program, we are honoring the life of Ponca tribal leader Chief Standing Bear, who took a stand for civil rights in a federal courtroom nearly 150 years ago. There's a new documentary about Chief Standing Bear and the journey of his statue to Statuary Hall in Washington, D.C., and here's an excerpt.
There's so many people that don't know the story of Chief Standing Bear.
Standing Bear is widely regarded as the Martin Luther King of Native America, as its first civil rights champion.
He was the one who actually gave the ability for Native Americans to be in a completely different status.
The United States government and people in general knew nothing about Indians other than warfare. They weren't used to Indians being in a courtroom.
He stretched out his hand and said, "That hand is not the same color as yours, but if I pierce it, the blood that will flow from my hand will be the same color as yours. I am a man. God made us both."
It's indigenous people are the embodiment of these words, right? Because it stood for Indian people. That's why it's so important, because it stood for Indian people.
My sons will be able to see a Ponca person in the United States Capitol. We are still here.
And that was an excerpt from the new documentary about Chief Standing Bear, thanks to the Nebraska Council for Indian Affairs for that sample. The documentary was previewed Tuesday night at the Lead Center for Performing Arts at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. After the documentary was shown, there was a panel discussion with Native American leaders, the sculptor, and one of the co-directors of the film. Larry Wright Jr. is the leader of the Ponca Tribe of Nebraska. He was asked about the significance of the documentary to the Ponca people and also about the recognition in Statuary Hall.
You know, I think first and foremost for our Ponca people, the significance, and even before that, the story of him as a father making that commitment to his son to bring him home, the only home his son knew, the only home Standing Bear knew, to be buried with our relatives, our ancestors. That alone stands by itself, but I think the significance of Standing Bear and what he did shows today. We are here today in Nebraska as Ponca people because of what he did. And that will resonate from the time that he did that to this generation and future generations, because this is where we're from, and this is where we call home. And we wouldn't be here if him and those that followed him didn't take that extraordinary step to come home and put themselves in harm's way, not knowing what they were going to face, if they'd even make it, but they were going to try. And we are definitely the beneficiaries of that sacrifice today. I think personally, you know, even today, I was in Niobrara late last night, today, and seeing the statue there before I left, knowing I was going to be here tonight, and knowing that his statue overlooks our homeland, overlooks his gravesite, overlooks the Niobrara River, and 1,300 miles to the east is a statue in the nation's capital. Not as many people will see it in our homeland, but we know that that's where it originates. But millions will see that statue in Statuary Hall. Millions of people who never heard of Standing Bear, never heard of the Ponca people, will hear our story and what our people went through. And just, again, as the video showed, everything that went into it. It doesn't do it all justice watching Ben make that and have an opportunity to see him do that. You know, the beads on the moccasins were each one individually rolled. And knowing that and seeing where it is and seeing that story for all of those that are here today, but, you know, our next generation, it's, you know, my kids haven't seen it yet. They've seen it in video. They've seen the pictures. They haven't had a chance to go there yet. And I want to be there when they do. And that's a story, as Katie talked about with her young boys, when they become old enough to really appreciate that, understand what that is, and the fact that they were part of that. But knowing from my generation, and I've said this story before, when our Ponca people were terminated in the 60s, you know, my father, my aunts, uncles, grandparents, relatives, all Poncas in that generation, and those that were alive at that time, they went from being Ponca and being Indian to being told you don't exist. And when I was born, the Ponca tribe didn't exist. And when my children were born, the Ponca tribe was here again because of the work and the sacrifices and the struggles and the fights that those our leaders at that time wanted to bring our people back. And so through all of those generations of fights and termination, relocation, and the constant battles our people fought to see that statue in the Capitol brings it all home. And it'll be there for as long. I hope it's there longer than what the last statues were, because when you see that statue in that hall amongst all the rest, it stands out without a doubt, and it draws everybody to that story, and that story resonates, I believe, with anybody from any nationality, because of what it was and what it continues to be.
That was Larry Wright Jr., the leader of the Ponca Tribe of Nebraska. Also last night, one of the co-directors of the documentary spoke. Judy Goshkibash is the executive director of the Nebraska Commission on Indian Affairs. Judy is also an enrolled member of the Ponca Tribe of Nebraska. She said Chief Standing Bear's journey to Statuary Hall has been an experience like no other.
This was a unifying story that brought us together. As you saw out there at the dedication, there were people from both sides of the aisle. And almost anyone that hears this story of Standing Bear can't help but feel the love of your child, making a promise, keeping your word. And so I say to all of the children watching, especially the tribal children, we are here, we were here, we will be here forever. And this is a reminder of that, and I hope many of you will get to go to the Capitol in Washington, D.C. and see Standing Bear. But if you don't, you can come here to Centennial Mall, or you can go to the Ponca Homelands and learn about Ponca Chief Standing Bear. And dreams can come true and do come true in America, and we do have good people like Don Miller Campbell and brilliant filmmakers like Ingrid, who went away to Columbia and came back, and it's just been a pleasure. I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed working with her. And Ben, well, Ben has 3 sculptures in Statuary Hall. Not only was he the youngest person, but he has the most. And from the very beginning, he was so inspired by the story and learned so much about it, and he listened to us as he developed that and designed. And so again, I say it's a magical time. And even though right now, as Indian people often are invisible, we in America are fighting an invisible enemy, the COVID. But we will prevail, just like Standing Bear and the Ponca people did. And through that, what we've done here, we're all going to get better and stronger. So. That's what I think, and that's what it means. And I think, am I surprised it happened? Sometimes I am. Sometimes I'm surprised. I wake up and can't even believe it. I'm so lucky. I'm so blessed by what I do for our people and by my family, my children and my grandchildren. This is just a gift that keeps on giving, and it's a legacy that I'm honored to have played a little part in.
That was Judy Goshkibash. She's an enrolled member of the Ponca Tribe of Nebraska, a co-director of the documentary about the life of the Ponca leader, and she's also the executive director of the Nebraska Commission on Indian Affairs. Judy and Ponca Tribe leader of Nebraska, Larry Wright Jr., took part in a forum last night at UNL after a screening of the new documentary about Chief Standing Bear's journey to Statuary Hall. And now we'll hear the final part of the Standing Bear story by Jim Scopp.
The Standing Bear Story, Part 4. It's near to 9, the evening of May 2, 1879. The courtroom is standing room only. It's the second day of a trial that pits a weary band of indigenous people against a massive law and order government. The Omaha courtroom features the famous Indian fighter Brigadier General George Crook, who often took to the military field in buckskin, civilian togs, but today he's donned his full dress uniform. Just 3 years earlier, the nation's celebrations at its own big centennial commemoration were muted by bloodletting at Little Bighorn. Another man in that room captures even more attention than the famous general. An eagle feather dangles from his braided hair. His shirt is bright blue. He wears blue leggings and deerskin moccasins, and a red and blue blanket is flung over his shoulders. His huge bear claw necklace hangs around a brass medallion featuring Thomas Jefferson. He could have worn white man's clothing, but Standing Bear wore his own full dress uniform. Native people were rarely in courtrooms back then. They were Indians. They had no rights. Their being in that courtroom was unheard of, but dozens of spectators had been reading local papers and knew the backstory. They wanted to bear witness. Rather than rounding up the Ponca and herding them like longhorns back to warm country, General Crook had plotted something unforeseen. In a secret meeting, he'd urged a local attorney to obtain a writ of habeas corpus in defense of the Poncas, a move that could bring Standing Bear and his people into court for the very first time. Crook's mind and soul had determined there simply had to be a better way than more bloody war. It's late, after 9. Lengthy speeches have stretched the proceedings. The case has stimulated passions. Should the Ponca be allowed to return to the Niobrara, their homeland, or should the government send them back once more again to the place where all of the nation's indigenous would supposedly eventually live? Is Standing Bear free, or are his people free? Standing Bear raised his hand, looked at it before speaking, and then, translated by Suzanne LaFleche of the Omaha people, spoke in his own Ponca language. "That hand is not the color of yours," he said to the judge in a voice deeply pitched, "but if I pierce it, I shall feel pain. If you pierce your hand, you also feel pain. That blood that will flow from mine will be of the same color as yours," he said. "I am a man. The same God made us both." He described a dream. He and his wife and child climbed a bluff that overlooked the swift running water of the Niobrara and the graves of his fathers. Only one man stood between him and his homeland in that dream, he said. He faced the judge and pointed, "You are that man," he said. The silence lay deep all around. Someone in the audience began to clap, then cheer. Soon, many joined in. Brigadier General George Crook, the Department of the Platte, commander at Fort Omaha, stood in his fine dress uniform, walked across the courtroom floor to Standing Bear, and shook his hand. 10 days later, the judge offered his ruling. Never before had he adjudicated a case marked by such extremes, he said. A people weak and unlettered and generally despised, pitted against the government of one of the most powerful, most enlightened, and most Christianized nations of modern times. That whole decision appeared in the Omaha Daily Herald and then in the Chicago Tribune. And then the New York Daily Tribune. Out in Omaha, at least, the New York paper said, the idea has come to the surface at last that an Indian is a man with human rights. Standing Bear and his people, carrying with them the remains of his son, were free to go, free to return to the land of his people, free to be human, holy and blessedly.
And that's it for this special edition of The Exchange about the life and legacy of Chief Standing Bear of the Ponca Tribe of Nebraska. His image now graces Statuary Hall in Washington, D.C. Thanks so much to Jim Scopp of Small Wonders for his series about Chief Standing Bear. I'm Mary Hartnett. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.